Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Transatlanticist podcast at the Americazentrum in Hamburg. My name is Andrew Sola. Very happy to announce a brand new series on our podcast, Novel Romantics, our podcast about contemporary American fiction. I'm also delighted to introduce our host of Novel Romantics, author and professor Douglas Cowie. Doug is originally from Chicago, Hamburg's sister city. Since 1999, he has lived in both England and Germany. He is the author of novels and novellas, including Owen Noon and the Marauder, Noon in Paris, Eight in Chicago, Sing for Life, Tin Pan Alley, and Sing for Life, Away You Rolling River. He is senior lecturer in the English department at Royal Holloway, University of London, where he teaches American literature and creative writing. In our first episode, we honor African American History Month. Dr. Cowie and his guest, Dr. Ali Bilas, discuss two crime novels by African American author Attica Locke. The first is called Bluebird, Bluebird, and the second is called Heaven, My Home. If you haven't read the novels yet, don't worry, there are no spoilers. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, to the Novel Romantics podcast. I am indeed the host, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and teacher, and my guest today is Dr. Ali Bilas. Ali Bilas is senior lecturer in education at University of Bedfordshire with teaching and research interests in literature and philosophy. He's published academic and journalistic work on, among other things, crime fiction, which we'll be talking about today. He also spends a lot of time listening to and thinking about jazz. And most excitingly for me, he's also a competitive strongman. He can lift boulders onto platforms
things.
And things like that. So welcome, Ali, and thanks for joining me on Novel Romantics.
Thanks very much for the intro.
You're very welcome. I felt like it was important to me to mention your competitive strongman pursuits. Today we're going to talk about two novels by the Los Angeles-based writer Attica Locke, Bluebird, Bluebird, and its sequel, Heaven, My Home. The novels both center on the character of Texas Ranger Darren Matthews and his investigation into crimes, murders and kidnappings mostly, that may or may not have connections to a white supremacist organization called the Aryan Brotherhood. Before we get into the details of the novels themselves, I want to ask you, Ali, about the crime fiction genre in general, since you've studied and written about the genre quite a bit. And so I just want to ask, what are some of the important features of the genre as far as you're concerned? And what is it about the crime genre that interests you, generally speaking?
Sure. Yeah. And there's an answer to that that's very long-winded and goes around the houses, and it becomes something to do with my broader interest in genre per se, not just crime writing as a genre. The shorter answer, which you and listeners will probably thank me for, is provided by Attica Locke in one of her interviews, and I thought she answered this question really, really well. And one of the things that crime fiction does is it allows readers and writers to think about the sort of the way that issues of structural, systemic power relations and individual agency overlapped, intersect, block each other. That's a short answer, I think.
Okay, what are the features of crime fiction that allow for that to happen from your point of view? Like, I can think of a few, but I'd like to hear from you a little bit first before I start interrupting you.
Okay, I mean, well, I'd invite you to interrupt me, because this is one of those things that I actually find, it sort of sounds like a simple enough question, right?
Yeah.
But when we talk about, you know, the features of crime fiction, that's when things like, you know, our expectations of particular genre come into play, and that's when something like formula fiction overlaps with formula fiction. That's not a sort of particularly tricky term. I mean, you know, things that just, you know, it's almost like join the dots type writing. Okay, and there's plenty of that out there.
So, like, what you mean is like fiction that has to have certain ways of doing things. Like the plot must follow this line of doing things, or a character must behave in this kind of way because that's what we expect, and it's important for the the formula to fulfill our expectations. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. And you see that in sort of late 19th and early 20th century penny dreadfuls and dime novel writing and the pulps, right? And that's partly, yeah, as you say, it's partly to sort of fulfill certain expectations, certain plot demands, perhaps. It's also, you know, to sell copy, right? Because yeah. what we've come to know, and there's no getting away from this, what we've come to call crime fiction, which, let's face it, that's a really, really broad term. It's, you know, there's lots of individual texts that we could point to and say, well, yeah, that's kind of crime fiction.
But at the same time, like the book, I'm literally looking at it right now, says Crime Writers Association Steel Dagger winner, you know? So like,
yeah.
It's not just some outside imposed thing. It's a thing that writers themselves embrace or that the industry itself embraces. But I guess like the obvious thing to say is that like a crime fiction has a crime. But also like there's, when it comes to formula, and we can talk a little bit about what formula does or what it doesn't do. And I don't mean formula as necessarily a pejorative term, right? Yeah. But like, let's for the sake of argument, say like, oh, crime fiction usually involves like, you know, a hard-boiled detective or something, or there's a damsel in distress. These novels don't necessarily have those things, but like there's these expectations that we have going in that we expect to be fulfilled as a reader.
Yeah. But even then, I mean, and you've said it in the way you framed that part of the discussion, that question, but you've kind of framed a particular subgenre of crime writing, right? The hard-boiled tradition as opposed to the classic mystery. You know what I mean?
So it's, yeah. So can
these
I
things
tell
are
you,
relatively fine-grained.
So one of the things that's interesting about us discussing this is that you started out saying like, oh, I'm interested in genre in general as a thing of, you know, and not necessarily crime as a genre, but genre and how does genre work, which is always interesting to me because I've never been interested in thinking about literature in terms of its genre. And I mean, I know lots of people who are, and I can see the value of doing so and everything, but it just, for me, both, I suppose, as a reader and as a writer, genre is just something that has never interested me, and sometimes, to be frank, baffles me. And I think we're going to end up talking about this when we turn to talking about the books a little bit more specifically, and maybe now is the time to start doing that even. Like, that just, it's not, like, the idea of writing to conform to particular ways of doing things or particular expectations of doing things, or that I go and approach reading because, oh, this book is going to solve a crime in a particular way, or this is a romance novel and they're all going to live happily ever after at the end, and that's what I want, isn't something I really think about. I don't, and it's hard to kind of talk about this, I think, without sounding like a jerk. and I don't mean it in that way. Like, one of my friends and colleagues who's a science fiction writer, and I joke about Adam Roberts, he and I joke about this all the time. I always say, like, oh, would you prefer this novel if it had a rocket ship in it? And he says, yeah. And, you know, he always tries to convince me that what I'm writing is science fiction and that kind of thing. But it does do something for people. And there are certain things to be said for conventions and the way they work. And it's not like, as you said, everything is a genre and everything fits certain conventions. But sometimes I think those are enabling, and sometimes I think they get in the way. And I think that's true both for a reader and the expectations that a reader might bring to a book, because this is this genre, so it has to do these things. And if it doesn't, I'm going to get mad. But also for a writer. And I think this is something interesting with these Attica Locke novels, both of which I really, really like. But where I kind of get frustrated with at times when I see them kind of falling into those formulas you alluded to. And I want to talk about that, but I also want to say one thing that I think is interesting about crime fiction, and one thing that I think that Attica Locke in particular does super, super well with the genre, I suppose, of crime fiction, or one of some of the characteristics, is that it brings people who aren't from the same spheres or of society or the same worlds into each other's spheres. Not necessarily into conflict with each other, although almost always into conflict with each other, because conflict is where story arises for us. But it brings them together. It forces people who aren't alike or whose daily lives, their paths wouldn't cross, it forces them to cross. And it also, and I think another thing that she does really well, and she does both of these things in these novels, it also brings people whose daily lives do cross into new kinds of interaction with each other that reveal things. And I suppose all of this is a way of saying that crime fiction tends to be very plot-driven. So one of the things that I'm always teaching to my students is about the importance of plot versus character and how these things interact with one another. And without wishing to get too highbrow and stuff here, like Aristotle, who sets out in Poetics the kind of building blocks of how drama works, says that plot reveals character. It shows the nature of a decision. I think crime fiction in general can do that extremely well because plot is so important and activities are so important in it. But also I think Attica Locke particularly exploits those moments where of people coming into conflict and what that shows about who they are or who they want to be or how they want to behave versus how they are behaving. And we might look at some examples of that as we get going in a little further into our discussion. But I don't know if you want to respond to that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot in what you just said. One of the interesting things, I mean, I think you're right that there's, to say that crime fiction tends to be very plot-driven or plot-dependent, I think that is that's a kind of commonplace or an expectation, right? That's something that we map to the genre and just, and you know, I'm just saying this as a hopefully an interesting response. Dennis Lehane, you know, a well-respected crime writer and writer, I listened to an interview with him fairly recently. I listened to it recently. It's not a particularly recent interview, but you know, he said that, you know, yeah, I'm sure I'm a crime writer and the thing I'm least interested in is plot. But what he is interested in is character. And I don't have an awful lot to say about that because, you know, we'd need Dennis Lehane here to unpick that. But it's really interesting, I think, to have someone who in many ways is at the forefront of crime writing at the moment saying the thing that he's least interested in is plot, or what most of us think of as plot. I don't know.
Do you believe him? I do. Do you believe him? Because I'm always saying, like, you know, you should never trust what a writer says in an interview because they tend to, you know, say what sounds good in the moment or what will make them sound good, or they're just trying to. I don't mean that writers are dishonest necessarily.
No, I know what you mean. But it's a thing that
you're
might
always
come
just
out
trying
in
to
the
moment. Yeah, and you're always just trying to navigate a discussion about something that you've thought about in very different ways to what an interview asks you to think about.
No, I really like that as a question. Do you believe him? Because actually, so I would say I don't believe the Dennis Lehane who wrote his first novel, A Drink Before the War, which seems to me really, really plot driven and in places quite baggy, quite unnecessarily baggy. And if I remember to come back to it,
what do you mean by baggy?
That you could have trimmed that novel down by 50, maybe 100 pages.
All right,
and it would have been just as good.
Because there's just too much action.
Yeah, too much action. And also, I want to park this for a moment. I'll come back to it. But there's something that I'd like to ask you about, actually, to do with style.
Okay.
So come back to that in a moment. But yeah, the plot does get unnecessarily baggy. There's also something to do with the writing that, yeah, as I say, I'll come back to in a sec. So that's his first novel. Came out in the mid-90s, I think. Definitely in the 90s. I'm just, so 94-ish, 95, something like that. And he also wrote a short story called Animal Rescue, which became the script for the film The Drop. Do you know the film I'm talking about?
No.
Okay, so this is the last film that James Gandolfini ever made. Tom Hardy are in the lead roles. And that story itself has a kind of, quick footnote, has an interesting kind of history because Lehane wrote the short story, Animal Rescue. He then turned his own short story into a script, which became The Drop. He then turned the script, The Drop, into the novel, The Drop. Anyway, there's 10, 12 years between those two. And the point I'm making to respond to your question is I don't believe the Dennis Lehane who wrote A Drink Before the War that he's uninterested in plot. I do believe the Dennis Lehane who wrote the short story Animal Rescue, and it's a much more sophisticated piece of writing, a much more satisfying piece of writing, I'd say, and a lot less plot driven. But you know,
so you don't think that later writer is as interested as in plot. Sorry, you don't think the later writer is as interested in plot as the younger writer was?
No, exactly. And then we could get into all sorts of fairly pointless speculations about, well, to what extent was he is that first novel, is it him sort of almost second guessing the conventions of the genre? Do you know what I mean? Like trying to work out what do I need to do, or to what extent is it editorial advice? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, or also how to write. Because like every writer with everything that they write is just trying to work out how to write.
Yeah, yeah.
No matter how experienced or inexperienced they are. Because you every story that you want to tell, that you have an idea that you want to tell, starts to put different pressures on you. You have to try and figure out, like, I think this comes back maybe to what we were saying earlier about formulas. It's like you want to lean into formulas maybe because they're comfortable and they're easier at times. But depending on your ambition for what you want to do, and I don't mean ambition to like make money or whatever, like just your artistic ambition for anything you write, those formulas might not work for you anymore, or you have to figure out all over again, well, how is this story served by writing in this way or approaching in this way? I don't want to get too hung up on maybe yakking about plot all the time, but it's one of the things that's, I've always considered myself a writer who, not that I'm not interested in plot, I'm just not very good at it. Like I always think, man, plot, like, you know, it's hard to kind of make a story that's exciting or goes places, partly because if you know the end of, you know, if you're the one writing it, you already know how it works. You know, there's no surprises to be had. And so reading something like Bluebird was particularly exciting to me because of how great the plot is and how just clearly well constructed it is. I mean, and this is a writer who also writes for the screen.
For TV,
and screenwriting, and screenwriting is always about plot. Like, you know, it's a very different medium to writing for the page, and it's visual and it's story driven more than anything else, and you can see all the good of that in Bluebird, and in Heaven My Home. Though in Heaven My Home, I think the plot, so it's interesting to read these two novels together, Bluebird, the first one, and then the sequel Heaven My Home, because the plot doesn't seem as tight to me in Heaven My Home. In fact, and we might come back to this, like, I just think Heaven My Home should have been shorter and part of, it should have been one long novel with a little bit less plot in the second one, and it would have all kind of fit together, because I think she's such a brilliant plotter, and it's so exciting to me to read something like that and to think about it and to learn from it, because you just see someone slotting things into place, and some of those plot moments are surprising as you read them. Some of them aren't surprising. You see the way the story is going, and that's kind of one of the interesting things about reading a novel that's about solving a crime, is like you expect the crime to be solved at the end, or if it's not going to be solved, you expect to understand why it hasn't been solved. My experience of crime fiction is mostly reading the Magre novels of Georges Simenon.
Right.
And those, you know, Magre solves the crimes. I think there's one that he doesn't solve, and it's I think that's the one called Magre Gets Angry. Like, he's angry because he can't solve the crime. I might be wrong about that. I can't remember, but because I've read so many of them, and I slightly forget which ones are which. But you know, you expect if the detective isn't going to solve the crime at the end, you expect to know why or how the detective couldn't solve the crime.
Yeah.
And so part of that reading experience is that some of the things you see coming and some of the things you don't see coming, and the real skill, or part of the real skill of the writer, is guiding you through that and making you feel surprised at times and making you understand and not be surprised but still be excited about what you're reading as you go. And I think she does that really, really well. And there's moves that she does and doesn't make, because like every plot move is a decision, right? It doesn't have to inevitably be that this guy was the murderer or whatever, or that this guy was the bad guy and this guy was the good guy, but the good guy did a murder or whatever it might be. It doesn't have to be that way. The author can make a different decision. And she, sometimes you see her making decisions that are less obvious, and those are very interesting to me. So before we get too far into my vague ramblings about plot, maybe it would be a good time to
summarize
say
the plot.
What's the plot? So I don't know, Ali, do you want to talk through Bluebird, or we can take them both as they're these two novels. So Bluebird is the first one.
Yeah.
Heaven My Home is the second. They're really, they're a, a, a partners. The Heaven My Home picks up literally in the same moment where Bluebird left off and continues the same story with some new twists and directions.
So the central character, the protagonist, is Darren Matthews, Texas Ranger, and is important to these books. It's important that he's black, right? African American, Texas Ranger, and in Bluebird, he's actually on suspension, isn't he?
Yeah.
At the very beginning, and how do we do this without giving away too many crucial spoilers? For various reasons, he insinuates himself in a double murder case in a nearish by town called Lark, and he's about to get his ass handed to him for doing this off the books, but then he actually starts to turn up some interesting possible leads on a white supremacist group called the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. So, you know, he's allowed to carry on his investigation. How much more of this one should we give away, Doug?
So I'll give away a little bit more. I think we're not going to ruin the novel for anyone. Yeah. There's been a murder in this small town. The guy who was murdered wasn't from the town. So these are one of the things that's interesting about these novels as well is the setting. It's in East Texas, in small town East Texas. There's this guy who's passing through the town. No one's quite sure why he's been murdered. It's not clear why he's been murdered. This Texas Ranger who's been suspended for punching somebody gets involved in the investigation, but the investigation also ends up involving the local police. And he's quite a complicated character because he's from this area. He's got family in this area, and some of his family is prominent. One of his uncles is a former Texas Ranger. One is a law professor. He's moved away and come back, and he's got all kinds of different conflicts of being an insider and semi-outsider and his own sense of identity and how it's drawn up in being a black man from East Texas in this racially complex, I think, world, which is one of brings me back to what I said about what's so interesting about what crime fiction can do, is that it gives a really interesting filter or lens through which to understand those racial complexities or interracial complexities.
Yeah, and that's clearly part of her project, but I reckon we're going to end up talking a lot about that, so let's do the part two.
Oh yeah, so Bluebird so it's a little bit trickier to talk about Bluebird without giving away what happens at the end of it's complicated to talk about Heaven My Home without giving away what happens at the end of Bluebird, but to try and do so without ruining the book for everyone, because you might want to listen to this, maybe you're listening to this podcast before you read the book, or maybe you've already read it, but there's a certain amount of the story, although the crime itself gets solved, the murder itself gets solved in Bluebird.
Yeah.
In really interesting ways. There's still some lingering threads to that story that are unresolved because of these complicated interactions of place, the different groups with their different power claims and needs, and because of Darren Matthews and his own personal stake in these things. And the second novel picks up with that untied thread, still untied. Yeah. But, and this is where I'm not getting into spoiling anything, there's a new wrinkle that there's been a kid has disappeared in another nearby small town. In fact, a place so small that no one seems to even know it's on the map, yeah. Which I kind of like as a... you think about the things you do as a writer where you're trying to create a world that looks real, that is real, but is also made up and fictional. And, you know, there's this real place, East Texas... there's places where you want to say that bad things are happening and you want to call racists racists and things like that, but you don't want to call actual people anything libelous, and so you create a town that even people who live nearby haven't heard of. And I kind of like that. But anyway, there's this little I think he's like 9 or 10 year old.
Yeah, he's a 9 year old boy.
White boy whose father is in prison because he was a leader of this white supremacist gang, this Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. He doesn't appear in the first novel. He's another member of this organization. he's in prison. This boy gets kidnapped and disappears, and the novel really becomes the story of trying to find this kid, find out if this kid has been murdered or is still alive, and it ends up unraveling a lot of history. It's very interested in history, Heaven My Home, in a way that Bluebird is less interested in history, I think. It's more interested in politics than history. And Heaven My Home kind of gets into the history and the politics of a place, the history that makes the politics of a place.
Yeah.
And it's about unraveling that thing. And I wonder if now is a good time for me to just read out a little bit of that novel.
Sure.
One is where she does an interesting thing of basically sort of summarizing the plot and telling you what's at stake in the plot. And this doesn't really give anything away either, so you don't need to run away from your podcast device if you're listening and haven't read the book. But there's this great moment where Darren Matthews is sort of, well, he's trying to convince his boss to let him stay on the case. And this moment for me kind of gets to the heart of what's interesting, so interesting about these novels in particular, and I guess about maybe about crime fiction in general, if we can extrapolate to that point. But it says he told Wilson is his superior officer in the Texas Rangers. He told Wilson of Rosemary King's odd behavior, the attorney she had nearly attached to her hip from the time Darren had met her, which stopped all manner of questioning, including that involving Marion County's latest mystery. He told Wilson about Monica Maldonado, the noises in the room, the run-in with Gaines, the lies, the notary who couldn't find her, and the fact that she seemed to have completely disappeared. Wilson chuckled faintly at the end of it, as if he thought Darren were reaching for something else to do out there to avoid leaving town. Thought you said things were good at home. I think it's just so great. Like, in just really simple summary of what's been going on in the novel, she also, if you've read up to that point, gets right into the heart of all the different things that are at stake, yeah. Both in that, in the kind of political world of this town, or this county, Marion County, and in what's personally at stake right at the end with that stinger from Wilson, thought you said things were good at home, that he's having trouble with his marriage, which is one of the plot things I don't think is so effective in these novels, but also here is still at stake nonetheless.
Yeah.
And, you know, one man's opinion isn't the value of the novel anyway. It's just my view of it. I just think that's such a great kind of simple writing that also reveals so much stuff just in the telling of plot. And then the other thing, and this is characters coming into conflict with each other and kind of the ways in which this is partly a function of genre, as maybe gets to back to my opening question to you about like what's interesting about thinking about things in terms of genre. And here, what's interesting about thinking about these novels in terms of how genre works and what genre can really do for a writer or for a story, I suppose ultimately it's like, what does genre do for a story and how we learn something from that story, is here, where you have, okay, there's different levels to it. There's a criminal in prison interacting with a law enforcement officer. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. It's also a white supremacist interacting with an African American. There's also a very interesting power balance here, because the white supremacist is also the victim of a crime. His son has been kidnapped right at the beginning of the novel, so I'm not giving anything away still. So he's a criminal who's in prison. He's in prison for the whole novel. He's for crimes that don't have anything to do with directly with the plot of the novel. But he's also the victim of a crime because his kid's been kidnapped and might be dead. We don't know. He's convinced he's not. Other people are convinced the kid is dead. That's one of the things that's interesting about how the story plays out, actually. You have a law enforcement officer who therefore, kind of by the nature of his job, has power over this criminal white supremacist victim of crime. But also the white supremacist has power over him in certain ways, because he wants something from him. He can give him information that he might want about the crime syndicate. You know, there's all these different power relations, yeah, yeah, all at stake. And these two guys are sitting in a room talking, and they both want a variety of different things for themselves and from one another, and some of those things lie outside either of their control. And so then there's this conversation with them that Hold on, I've just turned to the wrong page. I was going to read something else.
While you're doing that, it's possibly worth saying one of the things that Attica Locke has talked about in relation to Heaven, My Home, is you know, is her. This was written out of her political anger, right? And one of the reasons why, she uses this situation of the kidnapped son of a possibly former white supremacist. Behind all this, she was asking herself, I don't know if you've listened to these interviews, but the burning question in this book for her is, could she ever forgive people who voted for Trump?
Yeah.
This book is really kind of coming out of that kind of rightwards populist lurch that America's seen, and her anger at that. And for her, this was a book about the possibilities of political healing, but also personal forgiveness.
Yeah.
Which is why she plonks Darren Matthews in this situation.
Yeah, that feeds perfectly into the passage I'm going to read out, actually. And something else that we can circle back to after I've read it, maybe, because I was going to talk about that Trump thing. It's very interesting the way that she, with a very light touch, makes it very clear that this is about this moment of Trump has been elected and what's going to go on. Like, there's a lot of discussion between the law enforcement people about, it's set between his election and inauguration.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, we can do this now while we know there's still political will to do these kinds of, because the FBI comes into it. And so it becomes a sort of federal issue. There's that political question of like, we can still do this now because we're still in the Obama administration. And her first two novels, she's written two other novels, are set right at, you know, when Obama has been elected. So there's an interesting political thinking going on there and portrayal of the politics of, or the lived politics of electoral politics, if that makes sense, or the social politics of electoral politics.
Yeah, and it should be said as well, shouldn't it, that this, you know, Heaven, My Home is so recently published that she would have been writing this. When you look at the really quite small gap between Bluebird, Bluebird and Heaven, My Home, she would have been writing this, gearing up for an election, but not knowing what, you know, but not knowing. Most people would have read this as or just after Joe Biden becoming president-elect, right? Roughly, I guess, right? or in the lead-up at least. So this would have been written as she was gearing up for this election, not knowing the outcome.
Yeah. So let's get into how that works in a story. And here's So this is Bill King is the white supremacist being spoken to in prison by Darren, our Texas Ranger. And well, I'll read from this part. He's talking about Bill is in prison because he, as the initiation ceremony for this white supremacist group, they basically just have to go out and kill an African American, and done so, and he's been caught for it. Again, all that happens off the page, so to speak, or outside of the direct plot of this story. It's kind of the background to who this guy is. But it can't be Bill, Darren said, feeling a hot stone lodge in his throat, so his voice came out hard and mean. I help you find your son, and who gives Keisha and Jared their daddy back? How does that work? You telling me your redemption matters more than theirs? You think that saving your white son, who, by the way, is probably a racist shit, like just like his dad, so you can clear the little fantasy that he's not out of your head now, you think that will make it all right for Keith's kids? Bill ran his grimy fingers through his closely cropped hair. The chains connected to his handcuffs rattled against the table. He seemed beat by this, undone by Darren's withholding of praise for his moral rebirth. He so badly wanted this black man to pat him on the back for what millions of people managed with ease, not hating every black person they saw. Bill pleaded for grace. I am laying my body on the line for my sins, man, every day, every day. Darren looked directly into Bill's watery eyes. And it still ain't enough. It's a great couple of paragraphs. There's so much movement there in their conversation that it ends up in a place very different from where it starts. It goes through a couple of moves while it's happening that, you know, Darren gets to kind of bawl this guy out and tell him exactly what he thinks. And the anger is all embodied in this character. So even if it's Attica Locke's anger, like you were just describing, she's really embodied it in this character. She then gives the white supremacist his due and lets him, you know, this is a guy who's kind of, he's found God in prison and he's trying to
be the shepherd. He's been reformed.
Yeah. He's trying to be the shepherd, as Samuel L. Jackson's character says in Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction.
The question is always there is whether this is real or whether he's, you know, saying what he thinks he needs to say to get paroled. That question is left open in the novel. You have to kind of decide as a reader. You have to take a moral position on it, which is interesting.
Yeah.
There's times in novels and also in these novels specifically where you're definitely kind of told where to land on the moral scale, right? As a reader, like you read and you know that the author wants you to sit here and side with these people over these people. And with this character, there's something more ambiguous or there's something to be ambivalent about. Like, you don't necessarily have to decide that you side with Darren in this conversation. The conversation is uncomfortable and difficult, regardless of which side you decide to sit on or whether you decide not to sit on a side. And I think that's, so she said in one of the interviews that you've been alluding to, she says, it's the one that on the Los Angeles Review of Books from a few years ago, and she's talking about different novels than these two. But she said in that interview that she always tries to give her characters their due, that I wrote down the quotation. She says it's about not being cheap with people, good or bad. And I think that's a really, so I believe Attica Locke, to come back to my earlier. She is not cheap with her characters ever. None of her characters are cheap, and none of them get treated cheaply, no matter how lousy they are, no matter how mean they are, no matter how good they are. They get shown and they get treated honestly, I suppose, or clear-mindedly. They're never entirely right. They're never entirely wrong. There's play in there, and you see it. It's not just like, oh, which there is some of this in these novels of, like, you know, the cop doing bad things or things he knows to be, I suppose, legally or procedurally questionable for the right reasons, which is always a part of these kinds of stories. It's part of what makes them interesting.
Yeah,
and there's some of that, but it's not just that. It's also just about, like, and this character, Darren Matthews, is particularly good for these reasons, is that he's always kind of questioning his own motivation and things. You see it there, and in fact, the passage that I landed on earlier that was the wrong one, it's now become the right one. he is talking to Wilson, his superior, again. He didn't think he'd ever heard those words from Wilson. Wilson's just said, "I back you 100%. He didn't think he'd ever heard those words from Wilson, and hell if it didn't cross his mind that to save a white child, he was being given carte blanche to go around to the locals here. That with this one, he had Wilson in his pocket." So there's power dynamics again on show there. "A matchhead's flame of anger lit in his chest and extinguished itself just as quickly. Did he think the missing blonde boy lit a fire under Wilson? Yes. Did it mean the boy didn't still need his help? No. Could he possibly keep Leroy out of prison? Yes." And it's like that's not being cheap with your character. There's a guy admitting to some of his own small-mindedness, admitting to some of his maybe not small-mindedness, maybe that's unfair to Darren Matthews, admitting to some of his conflicts and admitting to the power structure that he's in and the games that he has to play in order to achieve what he wants to achieve.
But and this comes back to, I mean, the Attica Locke interviews, the ones that are available, are well worth listening, I think. I don't know what you think about them, but it's going to sound like a crass thing to say, you know, oh, surprise, surprise, a writer talks well about her work, but actually she's got such a fine grained, such a nuanced conception of what she's doing with her, I was about to say with the genre, but no, but just with her books, with her Darren Matthews series. And she's a really fascinating, a really compelling speaker. And it comes back to that earlier point that what she does with Matthews, where these books, you know, really, 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 really great, really brilliant, is where she does, as you're saying, articulates these kind of conflicts between individual agency and political power structures and those sorts of things, right? And that's where she does that. She negotiates those things really well. And it is also, it's particular to him being, or again, part of the cleverness of these books is making him a Texas Ranger, right? And a Texas Ranger who's uncomfortable with his own role, with his own position, because and this kind of overlaps with some of the things you were saying about the geography of these stories, right? That the Texas Ranger has got statewide privileges, so it allows her to move the story really convincingly around the state, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I just realized that I was nodding to everything you were saying, and that nodding is not really a good reaction to a non-visual medium. It also allows him to, again, it's like she's so interested in the dynamics of racial politics, and it gives him a really interesting position. He's you know, he can walk into, and she uses this extremely well in all kinds of different types of situations in across both novels, that he can walk into a bar as a black man, and he can pull out his badge and be a Texas Ranger, and he sometimes makes decisions about how he presents himself and how he talks and how he, the things he refers to, his cultural reference points change depending on who he's talking to, whether he's, you know, he'll be talking about blues music with this person, and he'll be playing, you know, I'm an intellectual who went to the University of Chicago in this other setting, as a way of depicting and telling stories about the kinds of stories we tell ourselves about our own identities, and about how we present our identity to other people in order to function in a society, are really, really interesting. And she's so good at that. You know, you said she talks well about writing. She's just, you can just tell in those interviews, and you can tell from reading the books, to be frank, that this is a really, like, this is a deep thinker. This is someone who's, so like there's lots of things in these novels that I don't think are that great. They're not enough to make me not like the novels particularly, but they're just things that irk me. They tend to be where she falls into leaning into the genre to do the genre things that the genre needs to do, because they, for me, a lot of those things get in the way of that just really elegantly articulated deep thinking, which happens again and again and again. There's so many, like, I've already read out a couple of those passages that I think work that way, but there's so many passages that are just short, right to the point ways of excavating themes or motivation, either kind of the stories or authorial motivation or a particular character's motivation. It works on kind of bigger schemes and smaller schemes, that she's just so good at it. And there's times where I just think, well, this story could be tighter and more complex if some of these other things didn't get in the way of it. I want to come to an example of that, in fact.
Okay, and you're thinking particularly of the second one, though, aren't you? Of Heaven, My Home.
I'm thinking of both of them. So here's just another example of here. She basically just lays all the themes down again. Daily, he marveled with befuddled anger at what a handful of scared white people could do to a nation. He never again wanted to hear them question the point of rioting in Ferguson or Baltimore, or Watts in Detroit for that matter, hear them wonder why black folks would torch their own neighborhoods because in an act of blind fury, white voters had just lit a match to the very country they claimed to love, simply because they were being asked to share it. And that's the bit that stung, the hurt that cut bone deep. After years of being lulled into believing that the universe bent toward justice, he saw how little friends and neighbors thought of his life, of his right to this country. And then she says, after Obama, it was forgiveness betrayed. And so, like, this, his personal kind of view on, you get some 20th century social history in there, you get his own thinking about it, you get her as the author slightly outside of that mapping it to the bigger social political events of the country, which I really like. I like that sense of awareness. There's other passages I could quote, but I won't, because I don't want to quote too much. But there's so many places where you just see her doing something that I think is super important for fiction in general. Mapping the concerns of a particular story to the concerns of the society in which that story sits. Like this, I'm going to try and articulate something that's a little bit complicated, I think. I'm going to try and articulate it as straightforwardly as I can. That, like, it's very easy to think of novels as just made up things, or any kind of fictional stories. This is just a made up thing, and it doesn't really change the world. It's not asking to do anything. It's just a kind of, it's an escape, or it's an entertainment, or whatever. And what she's really hyper aware of, and makes part of the fabric of these novels in a way that, like, she's hyper aware of it, but it's not self-consciously expressed in the novels. It's integrated into the fabric of the novels and the way she tells the stories and the language she uses to tell the stories, the kind of poetic turns of language that she uses and some of the metaphorical language she uses and some of the imagery that she gives. The sense that a novel is a real thing and it's a real part of a real conversation. So I can sit on my sofa at home reading Bluebird, Bluebird, and I can read Heaven My Home, and I can enjoy them, and I can, you know, tell my friend, these are fun novels. In fact, I was told to read them by a friend of mine. My friend Peter said he reads lots of crime fiction. He loves crime fiction. This is partly my interest, I guess, in asking these questions about genre. And he said to me, these novels are just, they're so, to me, as someone who doesn't think of himself as a guy who reads literature, these seem really literary to me, and I want to know what you think, because you teach literature. And so I was like, all right, I read them, and I see what he's getting at. But she's really aware of these things as part of a conversation that is a political conversation, that's a social conversation. It's not just a literary conversation, or not just an escapist thing that you do at the end of your work day to unwind, or what you do before bed because you can't sleep without kind of taking your mind somewhere else. Like, this is like serious, engaged, like political, I'm tempted to say action, like it's political action, these novels. Like, they are serious engagements with the society that the author is living in, and they're serious refractions. I don't think reflections is quite the right word. Refractions of that society into a form that allows people to think about them. And I think she's really, really good at that. I don't know if you want to say anything else about that, or should I just do a hard, like, shift without putting the clutch pedal down and grind the entire transmission and talk about something that I don't particularly like about this novel.
Well, before we shift to that, no, I'm doing the nod now, because I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, I also want to say that, you know, for what it's worth, you know, what this guy thinks, that she also does the sorts of gestures you're talking about. She does them in such a way, like you say, they're so perfectly integrated into the fabric of the novel. In a way that other writers would find it hard not to make them just like clumsy expository lumps.
Yeah.
You know, like a kind of break, almost a break in the narrative, right? She does it so brilliantly and does it on things that I think are actually really, really difficult to do in the way that you've just described. Like early in the novel.
In which one?
In Heaven My Home, is it okay if I read a short bit?
No. Oh. I mean, yeah, go ahead. I'm the only guy. It's my podcast and I read. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
So you mentioned earlier on the two uncles, right? Again, a bit of fleshing out here. Darren's two uncles are twins, and that's an important conceit, because the one becomes a Texas Ranger, the other becomes a lawyer, then law professor, and these are the two men who raised him, and he feels pulled between the two, and he briefly goes to the University of Chicago to study law, and with the assumption being he'll go into, you know, become a lawyer, even a professor of law, something like that. But in the end, the pull of the Rangers wins, and this is one of the other tensions running throughout both the novels, right? So that's important because one of the uncles is mentioned in the bit that I'm about to read. He felt the disapproval of his late Uncle William, who'd been a Texas Ranger too, a man Darren revered for his integrity, for the blind faith he held in the rule of law. But Darren wasn't sure anymore that the law could withstand blindness. He'd protected Mac, character from the first novel, he'd protected Mac out of instinct because his own read of history told him a black man should have a right to his own fear. Otherwise, he would forever be dying because of someone else's. It's us or them, isn't it? The belief felt like a heavy brick in his chest, chipping away at the bones in his ribcage each time he took a breath, breaking him from the inside out. But did that make it any less true? Had anything in the weeks since the election proved his cynicism wrong? Maybe the rules had to be different. Maybe justice was no more a fixed concept than love was, and poets and bluesmen knew the rules better than we did. And I'll stop there, but do you know what I mean? I just think it's another example of something that could be a really awkward expository lump and is handled really brilliantly.
Yeah, and so there's a couple reasons why she handles that stuff brilliantly. It's partly that she always locates these things in. So these novels are really, they're told from Darren Matthews' point of view. They're third person. There's a a certain degree that you feel there's some space between the voice of the author and the perspective of the main character, but you're either watching him closely, or you're in his thoughts. You're often inside his thoughts, like you are there, basically, all the way through. I always think of it as like, you know, in some first person shooter computer games, like there's the version where you're holding the gun and you're looking down out the barrel of a gun, so you're kind of first person. Or you can, like, if you're like me, and that view always makes you feel a bit ill. Like, you know, like, especially back, like, in the 90s, when, like, Doom and Quake first came out, and they were, like, the movement really would just make me, like, literally physically nauseous. Anyway, but you can also, like, you can set it so that you're just behind the character, and you sort of see their head and their shoulders. And, like, this is, like, the head and shoulders view of the first-person shooter game in novel form that we get here. And so you're always kind of in... you're watching him closely, or you're inside of his thoughts at times. And so she's always, this is to come back to my main point here, what you're calling expository passages, they're always embodied. They're embodied in the mind of the character, and more importantly, in the actions of the character. Again, we're back to plot. So plot reveals character, reveals the nature of a decision, or I think it's character that reveals the nature of a decision, but they're all kind of tied up together for Aristotle. And here you're getting that. She's so careful about embodying these expository things in 100% relevant to the story she's telling moments. The influence of his father figures, his uncles, it bears on him in real ways, in the decisions he makes and how he goes about his professional life, which is what we're watching in the novels. And so it's organic to the character, it's organic to the story that the character is involved in, and that's why it works. It doesn't work in when you read novels where it's just like the author wants to read you an essay about what they think about, you know, racial politics, about the decisions of white people voting for Trump, as that passage I read out earlier is. And you're like, you know, get off your soapbox. I didn't come to a novel to read a political speech. But when that political speech is embodied and also has bearing on what he says before or after to this white supremacist guy, has bearing on what he says to his boss in order to get the things he wants, has bearing on how he walks into a bar.
Well, it has a bearing on the rest of the novel as
full
well,
full of
right?
white supremacists,
because it's about, it's about actually the sort of the conflict between the law and justice.
Yeah, it's totally, and she's so aware of that, and so it's some really supple thinking, and to me, perhaps more importantly, supple writing about that thinking. The way that the thinking gets embodied itself in the writing, the way the thoughts are embodied in the characters, so it works on the kind of imaginative level of imagining characters and their stories. It works on the expressive level of how you actually put the words together to make a sentence that expresses those things. I want to talk about, like, so here's a thing that where that kind of thing goes wrong. This is a small thing. It's, to some degree, it's, I suspect, a pet peeve of mine, but I think it's an important one. It's one that I think about a lot, both as a teacher and as a writer, actually. And she does this several times in this novel. And so I'm thinking of Having My Home Again. She does it less, actually, in Bluebird, which I think is the stronger of the two novels. But just listen to this. Something about Gil Thomason out of the picture released the pain and anger and fear the kid had been holding in for who knows how long. So that something is like the exact opposite. That word something is the exact opposite of everything I was just talking about. It's a kind of dereliction of duty in a way. I always think of it on the writer. Something about Gil Thomason out of the picture released the pain and anger. Anyone who's read the novel to this point knows what that something is and can articulate it. And in fact, Darren Matthews can articulate it in that moment. And in fact, Attica Locke can articulate it in that moment. But she's written something about this and this, and it makes me so angry. because it genuinely makes me angry. And it's not just, lots of writers do this. It's not just Etika Luck. I'm not just picking on her. And I hope, like, I feel so self-conscious because I just really like these novels a lot. But I also, the shortcomings irked me all the more because of how much I liked the novels.
Because of those moments of brilliance.
Yeah, and like whenever a writer says something, blah, 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 I think, no, your job as a writer is to tell me what that something is, to embody that something. And that something is that the guy is a bully, and the guy, the Gil Thomason, who's out of the picture, like beats up the kid's mom, beats up the kid, you know, is a, you know, has all these people hanging around who are obnoxious. The Gil Thomason isn't the kid's dad. Like, there's ways of articulating that, and the effort is worth it because it's, there's a million places in both of these novels where she gives you the something. So the thing I always tell my students is, like, your job as a writer is not to say something, it's to say what the something is, to name the something. And she doesn't do it, and it makes me angry. It makes me genuinely angry.
I can tell.
I'm getting angry just thinking about it all over again. And it's like, it's not just her. I read this in all kinds of novels, and it makes me mad every time.
Okay, but do you see that as a failed gesture, right? As a failed attempt to make the reader do the work? Or do you see it as just bad/lazy writing that hasn't been, like, again, we're saying this in the context of a writer who we admire and two really good novels, particularly the first one. But do you see that as just a moment, a lapse? Yeah, like I said, lazy or bad writing that hasn't been picked up? Or do you see it as a deliberate gesture, get the reader to do some work here that doesn't quite, for you, doesn't hit the mark?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a bit of a... It's not really. It turns into something of a sport or a game to say it's bad writing, it's lazy writing, it's a failed gesture. It doesn't really matter, and I'm not going to speculate. So it's a sport to sort of speculate on the intention or the approach of the writer in this respect.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't really matter. It's because it is bad writing, as far as I'm concerned. Like it's a small moment of bad writing.
Collapse,
it's not immoral or something. It's like the world isn't going to collapse because of it. But it just strikes me as a And I think I probably care more about it because I teach writing as well. But like, and so it strikes me as it's always a moment where the writing. And I think it's less to do with the writer than it is the writing, though. You know, the writer is the one who makes the writing. But the ultimate effect of it is that the writing doesn't stretch to a specific place where that. Stretching and naming the something there opens up a world and allows me to reflect back specifically. And you can pick an image that you've had earlier in the novel or an idea you've had earlier in the novel, and you place it in there. And something just kind of like, I'll skate over it. You know, it's not a song lyric. It's something that you can get away with in a song lyric. Something in the way she moves, you know, that's, you're like, okay, I'm with you, George Harrison. Yeah. But in a novel, in prose fiction, I want the precision there. And again, this might just partly be my pet peeve.
But I guess to me, it sounds like you're also saying this is a point in the novel where the point of the something is not that it's mysterious. Actually, it's all perfectly articulable and well known. So why make it a something? If your whole point were a gap, an unknown, a genuine something, then fine.
If it's something and I've got to figure it out, then I know I'm going to figure it out. I'm back to like what I expect from reading, I suppose. Whereas here, it's like, yeah, we all know what something is, and like everyone who's read the book thus far could say it. So find a way to say it that's sharp and clear and good. And like the other thing, so I want to say a couple other things about like plot and so on and convention, genre convention. And then maybe wrap it up and just say a few kind of final thoughts about the novels. Okay, so like, I want to come back to these things of conventions and things that I just don't quite work for me. All these things that we've been talking about are about Etika Luck putting together a story with real pull and a real core of set of concerns and ideas and themes that are being played out. And then there's these other things that just don't seem to have anything to do with it to me, that are about trying to, so we're back to the like, I don't care about plot, or I'm only interested in character. And there seem to be moments where it's like, oh, I should be more interested in character. I have to make Darren Matthews a compelling character, and so I better give him some depth. And like, so there's this whole, there's two things, and neither of this is giving anything away. One is his marriage is on the rocks in a kind of somewhat, always slightly ill-defined way, in a way that I think the wife isn't a very well-drawn character and kind of only seems to be there in order, sometimes almost as like a plot device that doesn't need to be there, or as like a way of giving him conflict that actually is all there. And so a lot of, we've already talked about a lot of the conflicts.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah.
And it just seems kind of like, well, I don't know, this, what is this doing? It just seems sort of conventional and I'm trying to think of a way to put it, like just sort of middle of the road. Like it doesn't seem like anything I haven't read before. Like 90% of these novels is stuff I haven't read before in exactly these ways. And that's what I always want from a novel. I want to read about ideas that I've thought about in ways that I haven't thought about or that are unique and whatever. And the kind of detective who's, you know, wife isn't happy about him being on the road. So it all just seems like, oh, I've been here before. It's not really, it doesn't add anything important to me to the story that I'm reading. It doesn't make him more interesting as a character. If anything, it makes him slightly less interesting to me. Again, this might just be me. And then the other thing is like, he's always drinking and there doesn't seem to be a lot of purpose to it. Like it sometimes like, oh, he's drunk too much. Or like there's a lot of attention to him drinking bourbon in particular. And it just like, I just feel like it's happening because that's a thing that happens in detective novels. So it should happen. And I don't get what any of it does. Like he can go into a bar without having a drinking problem. Like if he needs to go into a bar, like, or you can go into a bar and have a beer, like everybody does it. And that stuff just kind of felt like, it was always the moment that like weirdly pulled me out of the story. Like I'm totally involved in this story and my like frontal lobe is grabbed by it, and then I get yanked out because I have to like I have to wallow in his hangover or something. And if I can just complete this before I hand it back to you, I started thinking when I was reading these novels about, again, like one of my few touching points for crime fiction that I've read a bunch of is Simenon in those Magre novels. You never know anything about Magre. Like, you know that Magre has a wife who occasionally makes him a meal, or like every night when he goes home. And that's kind of all you ever know about his entire personal life is that he has a wife who loves him. And like, and that's it. You don't know anything about this guy. You just watch him solving crimes. And maybe this is something of like what I want from a story. And it's not fair to the writer to like...
To map those onto
yeah. But at the same time, they don't work for me, and it seems worth saying. They don't make me as mad as the something. I know my tone has sort of risen up to fever pitch now, but
you sound less mad about the something, but yeah. I know that means you're more mad about the something.
It was my quiet, yeah. Steely determination.
So I mean, so where do we start? I mean, we're sort of talking about genre conventions again. I know I need to keep this brief. But I think the crummy marriage, I think I know what you mean by that, because we're two books deep into what looks like it could be a relatively long running series, right? So that could turn into something. Sorry to use that word, Doug. But it could amount to something, right? Or it might go nowhere. Similarly, the struggle with the drinking problem. There's a million different ways that you could choose to signal to a reader, oh, this is a person who's constantly going through his own inner dialectic, right? And actually, there's one of the things you could say about these novels is that for a series that we're only two books into at the moment, he's been pulled in almost too many directions, and sometimes doesn't need to be pulled in so many directions, because actually the relationship with the memory of the one uncle, the other uncle who's still living, and his mother, and there isn't time to talk about her, but she's a really interesting character, that does an awful lot of work. That plus his difficulties with his job and his political professional role, that does an awful lot of work. So I see what you're saying with that. I think I do anyway. But let's see if it leads anywhere. The bourbon, bourbon is a stock, it's a prop, isn't it, in a lot of crime fiction.
A delicious prop.
A delicious prop, but a prop nonetheless. The interesting thing, so you've mentioned Maigret a couple of times now, and the interesting thing there is that in many ways we're talking about, again, two different traditions of crime writing though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure.
So in some ways the comparison only will only stretch so far anyhow, because there is a very, very different tradition of American crime writing, yeah, that this taps into.
Yeah, but all I really meant by that was like, there's a character who you don't need to know anything about to be totally great. Like, the story, like, Simenon seems to know that the story is the thing that's interesting, and like the guy is a kind of, there needs to be something there, and there's something there in Darren Matthews. He doesn't need to be everything, we don't need to know everything, but like, we're kind of reaching the end of our conversation. I wanted to just, there's like four or five other things that are great in these novels that I haven't even gotten around to, but as a way of just kind of sending our listeners out into the world to think about reading these books, or to think more about them if they've already read them, I just want to come back to this idea of contemporary racial politics in America, and then also the kind of racial history of America. And there's something, I think one of the wonderful things that these novels do, or wonderful is probably not the right word because it's pretty intense and hard, is that Attica Locke has really taken a story and a character, one character in particular, but the kind of all the other characters that orbit around this protagonist, and a place, East Texas, and ingrained that story with the history, and in particular the racial history of the United States, from like the ways in which, and one of the things that's really great in Heaven, My Home in particular, is the way the racial politics and the white supremacy and everything that is all on the surface and also then reaches down into the depths of the thematic workings of Bluebird move into their historical roots. They're very deep and long historical roots in slavery and in the aftermath of slavery and the aftermath of the Civil War, and how generation after generation after generation effects of those things are, and she's found very particular and at times peculiar, and I don't mean that in a negative way at all, far from it.
No, it's part of the brilliance of these.
The peculiarities in which those things express themselves in these novels, I think are just fantastic and really make these novels super worth reading. I mean, really, really interesting to me. I've thought about both of them quite a lot since I read them.
Well, I think to kind of bring things full circle, you know, we started off this conversation talking about genre conventions, and one of the things that the hard-boiled tradition, the sort of noir tradition of American crime writing does is, you know, in many ways it is a kind of literature of place, right? Often an urban literature. That's not quite what these books are, but what they are books about, as you say, they are mapping in really, really skillful ways, really broad cultural histories, and doing it in a really economical way. She was invited recently, Attica Locke, to speak about her work, but in relation to the theme of decolonization. And she said at the beginning of this lecture that it wasn't really a way, she hadn't thought of her work in those terms before, but the more she thought about it, the more she said that, you know, my writing is actually, it's about land. You know, it's about land and territory. And she writes about that. You know, one of the extracts you read had to do with whether or not people are willing to share a land that has plenty of space and plenty of resources in one way or another. She also writes in really deft ways in Heaven, My Home, about the expropriation of land from indigenous peoples. And I think she does that, you know, really quite brilliantly.
Yeah, I totally agree. We're posting this podcast as part of a way of touching on African American History Month, and I mean these are steeped in African American history, which is steeped in the history of white people in America in ways that are both obvious and less obvious, and again as a subtle, supple and deep way of thinking about those things through story, I think these novels are really fantastic, really, really fantastic. Ollie, thank you so much for joining me on the Novel Romantics podcast. And thank you to everyone for listening. And I hope you'll join me again every month for a new novel, a new topic, a new guest, but always keeping to contemporary American literature. Thanks, Ollie.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
You're very welcome.